sit down. I mean, you can if you want to, but I'll start the clock running. How are you?
Good.
I bet you. I'm sorry?
I'm Ken Nagy.
You've probably been listening.
I have been listening with great interest.
So
I hope I can clarify some of these issues for you.
Go right ahead.
And I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Maria Andrade of Boise.
How are you?
We both represent Noel Garcia, and he's what we typically call a bona fide complainant in this type of case. He was a disabled tenant of the South Pond Apartments for several years, had difficulty accessing one of these inaccessible multifamily units.
Casey, could you turn up the volume?
Mm-hmm, I am.
And Mr. Nagy, if you could speak up, that would help. Okay. You have a very soft voice.
Actually, we'll think maybe technology will take care of it.
Let's see.
Your Honor, this is another case in which we are trying to figure out when the statute of limitations is triggered.
Mr.
Nagy.
Garcia is in a wheelchair?
He is. He's nearly completely disabled as a result of meningitis in childhood. And he had difficulty getting in and out of one of these units. In fact, at times...
And his problem was absence of a ramp?
Yes, there was a lack of curb cuts. There was front steps to his apartment. The doors weren't wide enough to get the wheelchair through. There were problems inside as well, which are required to be constructed in a certain way as part of the design and construction requirements. So there were many violations, and I don't believe there's any contention that the apartment complied in any way. And there's no contention here that he filed his complaint within the 2 years of the completion of the design and construction. It was, in fact, 6 or 7 years after the design and construction that our complaint was filed in federal district court.
But in terms of when he encountered the condition, when did that happen?
That happened upon his first visiting the
complex. So he sued within 2 years of that visit?
2 years of the first visit, and I think that's a very significant date, Your Honor.
Did he actually rent the apartment? Or?
He did.
And did he seek any relief in terms of modification that we've heard about earlier, offer to pay for the modifications himself, and was refused under that?
Your Honor, there were some discussions with the management company about modifying, putting a ramp in, and in the end, he requested a reasonable accommodation. In the end, they indicated that he'd have to pay for that himself. Those defendants have settled with this plaintiff, and those issues are not before this court.
Right.
The current defendants or appellees are the designers and constructors.
Yes.
So,
So did he ultimately get some relief through the settlement? Or did
for the failure to reasonably accommodate.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question is, did they ever make any of the changes that he wanted, or did he just take the money and move out?
No, they never made any changes, and
so
he eventually moved out.
He resolved it basically with money damages, is that what?
That's correct. That was after he relocated to another apartment. Now, Your Honors.
So, I'm sorry, why does he still have a claim?
Because his claim is against the designers and constructors. They haven't settled with him. The earlier claims were for reasonable accommodation, failure to reasonably accommodate, because there were representations made that they would make his apartment more accessible. Also, at one point, he asked if he could move to a more accessible unit within the complex, and they said no, he would have to finish
it. But that's all the claims against the landlord, right?
That's correct.
Which is gone.
Those are gone.
So however badly the landlord may have behaved, or however well the landlord may have behaved, isn't really before us.
No, that's right. These appellees had sold the units. They were no longer owners of these units, and that was a new owner and new management company that were committed those violations, and those violations have been resolved through a settlement. Now, Mr. Garcia has brought a claim for the failure to design and construct. Same types of issues that are at issue in the previous case. And what I can figure is that there are three distinct approaches to determining when the statute of limitations runs in these types of cases. The Maseki Court out of the Eastern District of Virginia And that's the case that the Idaho court, the lower court, relied upon, held that the statute of limitations begins to run at the design and construction. They said that that was a discrete event. That's the violation. And if you don't file within 2 years of the design and construction, the statute of limitations has run. As this panel has recognized, what that essentially does is shifts the burden of modifications and the cost of that burden to the tenant, because now, of course, he can ask for a modification, and they have to allow it if it's reasonable, but he has to pay for it, and he has to pay to change it when he moves out. And I don't believe that's what Congress intended when it enacted a civil rights statute for the protection of the disabled.
But if the question that I asked Mr. Armneck in the prior case, if his answer is correct, then the original owner and the original architect, the builder, excuse me, and the architect, would be amenable to suit forever by another person like Mr. Garcia who moves in today or 10 years from now or 100 years from now.
Yes, Your Honor, until their liability is cut off through remedying the violations. And I believe that's the old St. Andrews case.
I'm sorry, I missed the last. I don't understand the last part of your answer. You said the liability is cut off for what?
When the design and construction violations are remedied.
Right. Okay. So the only way they can escape it is to remedy the problem. Now, how do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that, well, that's fine, but they don't control or own the property any longer? There's nothing effectively that they can do to remedy the violation?
Well, property owners can be worked with, and property owners can be pled into lawsuits. And in other cases, the courts have recognized, I believe it was a BNI case back east, where the court recognized that a owner could be made a party to the lawsuit in order to remedy those problems. And so these sorts of things can be achieved. The old St. Andrews case.
So basically, if we were to adopt your rule, if the current owner, or let's say the first purchaser from the original builder, if he were not prescient enough to include some kind of an indemnification clause in the real estate purchase contract, then he is potentially amenable to being drug into these suits forever as well.
I think that they could be made a party to a suit.
What is the purpose of the statute of limitation that Congress enacted? It doesn't sound to me like any kind of a limitation at all.
Well, if you walk your way through the statute of limitations, as Your Honor asked previous counsel to do, 3613 talks about enforcement by private persons. An aggrieved person may commence a civil action within 2 years. The definition of aggrieved person is provided in the Act as well, and it is a person who claims to have been injured by discriminatory housing practice or believes that such person will be injured by discriminatory housing practice. And if you look at 3604, which prohibits this conduct, 3604F1 prohibits discrimination in the sale or rental of housing. And that's the phrase that the old St. Andrews case, the Sixth Circuit, felt was very, very relevant in finding that you can't look at design and construction in isolation from the entire subsection.
So, as a practical matter, the only way that the current owner could insulate himself from continuing liability would be to either make all of the changes, widen the hallways and so on, or just shut the whole complex down and not rent it to anybody.
That's correct.
Which would seem to be sort of an economically dumb thing to do, or fruitless thing to do.
And sometimes civil rights statutes have an effect which we don't anticipate, but in fact, the purpose of the statute is to protect the disabled and other protected statuses. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has long said that the statute is to be construed in order to further the broad remedial intent of the statute.
But they do tell us that we have to give effect to all of the provisions of the statute, and I'm really wrestling with how I can give effect to a statute of limitation when your argument and the argument that I just heard in the Thompson case leads me to conclude, as the district courts did here and in Mosky, however you pronounce it, that it essentially reads the statute of limitation out of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, the statute of limitations provides that an aggrieved person can file within 2 years. There was no aggrieved person that we know of prior to this suit being filed. And so
But if they don't file within 2 years, that's okay. They can still file 2 years and a day later because it's a continuing violation. Every day is a new violation.
That's correct.
So it really does mean nothing at all. I mean, 2 years becomes wholly meaningless.
But Your Honor, the
it's 2 years from nowhere.
2 years from termination.
That's correct. But the converse of that is that you would be allowing these builders and constructors to escape liability for their violations if nobody files within 2 years, and that's something.
That's the nature of statutes of limitation. I mean, there's nothing sort of morally better about being within the statute of limitation than being outside the statute of limitation, or vice versa. You know, let's say you run over somebody with your car. I don't know what the statute of limitations for that kind of thing is in Idaho, but I think in California it's 1 year. Let's say it's 1 year, right? And for whatever reason, the person doesn't sue within a year. You know, then you've gotten away with it. You know, it's one of those things.
You had no chance to sue in this case, I take it.
That's
under
correct.
As if you got the car and you couldn't sue on the car because of a design defect because there was a 2-year statute of limitations on the car.
And that's the problem here. If I could sum up, I know I'm out of time, but the building was built more than 2 years prior to Mr. Garcia moving in. I think we would all agree that when they designed and constructed, that was an injury to Mr. Garcia, even though he didn't know about it, because it reduced the pool of accessible housing in Idaho to the disabled. So that was an injury. He had no way of knowing until he encountered those barriers when he first visited there. And this court has applied the discovery rule in these types of cases in the ADEA context, and those cases are cited in our brief. And the Maseki court looked at the ADE cases in the Fourth Circuit and said, well, our Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has rejected the discovery rule in ADEA cases. The statute of limitations section is worded virtually identically to the Fair Housing Act. Therefore, we won't apply that rule. And, however, in this case, we are constrained by those ADEA cases where the discovery rule has been applied.
Okay. You're out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. I've been asked to reserve 5 minutes of the 10 for the co-appellee for Mr. Erickson. It's my privilege. I represent Dennis Brockway. Dennis Brockway was the developer of the South Pond apartments that are issued in the Garcia versus Brockway matter. Dennis Brockway is an individual, built these what were called fourplexes, five fourplexes of apartments.
Sorry, you said he was the designer or the builder?
He was the builder.
Okay, thank you.
The builder and owner. And he sold, well, the completion of the last of the five units was complete in 1993. And then my client sold all of his interest, final interest in all of the apartments in 1994. So in 1998, he was very surprised when he received a complaint by the Idaho Fair Housing Council.
For example, when a builder builds a building, presumably they're on constructive notice of all of the building code requirements and so on that have to be complied with. Is that correct?
It's interesting. At the time he started construction in 1991, the Fair Housing Act was just applicable.
Yes.
I'm
just asking generally, building codes. I wasn't focused on the
Right. He received a certificate of occupancy from the city of Boise, which would have confirmed to him that the buildings were in compliance in 1993.
And in compliance with the Fair Housing Act?
Well, he interpreted it to be that.
But is that what Boise certificate of occupancy was communicating?
Well, it said that it complied with all applicable rules and regulations, which I think could reasonably be interpreted, although we're talking about a municipality as opposed to a federal agency.
Well, I'm trying to work our way through this. It's clear that somebody's wind up getting the short end of the stick on this, and I don't want to disguise that. I understand that on both sides. So I'm trying to figure out when Congress used the word termination, to address whether the statute has some cutoff. It clearly has it. You can cut off liability by terminating, removing the offending condition. Now, what's been brought out by you and then the other argument is that, typically builders sell off their property. They build them. They're not there to run apartments typically. So they won't be in possession or control. That may be true, but when they design a building and there are flaws in the building, be it construction flaws or failure to implement earthquake requirements, and some event comes along later and the building collapses, or in this case a disabled person tries to rent the building, it seems a little strange to think that the builder is off the hook because somebody who didn't know about the condition wasn't around to sue, unless maybe it was an activist disabled rights group. So given that sort of paradox, what is so bad about saying to a builder that, look, when you sell your building, if you're worried about downstream liability for defects in this building, you can insure against it by entering into in your buy and sell agreement. You can get indemnifications or whatever. What is so wrong with that regime? I mean, what's so drastic and draconian about it?
I don't know that there's anything wrong with that, but I would propose that there would be very few buyers.
Why is that?
Would agree to that. And I don't know that the insurance companies would provide insurance for that.
Well, it hasn't been resolved until recently that they weren't on the hook. So you're saying that people have just been buying willy-nilly without taking into account whether or not there's some exposure to the FHA?
There's some due diligence that is done by the buyer or should be done to determine whether they are in compliance. And I think one thing that might help is to, when you think about the attempt to apply the continuing violation theory, it's not an attempt to apply a continuing condition theory. And so these cases that have looked at whether the continuing violation theory should even apply here look at whether there was some ongoing act or practice within this, the time period 2 years before
the suit. Practice here in this case, because the analogy is to the employment cases and that, or the sign and all of that, that is a practice in that sense. Here it is creating the practice of the builder in this case was to build a building where the doors didn't conform, okay? And you want to say, well, the practice was really a construction decision and it's terminated. I understand the argument. I'm just trying to understand where we draw the line here.
Is if we don't cut it off, my client could be sued today.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
He could be sued 100 years from now.
Well, he could, or he could take steps to remedy it.
Well, let me ask you about that. I assume that these buildings change ownership more than once sometimes. How does the original builder protect himself from the fifth owner down the line?
He couldn't.
There would be no privity
of contract. Unless somehow he has a deal with the guy who buys it, that will be a part of the
sort of a covenant running with the land.
Yes. And I just don't think that's going to happen. And I think the other thing I wanted to focus on, and I'm cutting into my colleague's time, is that Mr. Garcia had a remedy. He had two remedies. He pursued one. He received one against the property manager and the landowner. Notably, he also lived in the apartment for 2 years. But he did sue the property manager. He sued the current owners, then owners of the property, and he received a settlement from them. He also had available to him the modification fund that my client had set up for victims of housing discrimination, not necessarily at South Pond.
But why did your – yeah, but that goes away. If your client didn't have any obligation, I mean, then he just did it out of the goodness of his heart.
He did.
Okay, so –
and it was for any housing victim, not – again, not necessarily South Pond.
But under your theory that – that he doesn't have any obligation to do that. That's just – it's fortuitous that he's a good guy and decides to pay into the fund. But he's got no liability after 2 years. Then he doesn't really have any concern there.
Well, I do think that some businessmen have
– No, I do, too. I'm not suggesting they don't. But you're saying he had – that the disabled person has a remedy. No, that's not a remedy. That's a fortuity. Maybe the reasonable accommodation or, you know, putting the burden on the current operators – I still have a little trouble understanding why the condition turns out to be an act of discrimination by the current owners. They didn't put it, they didn't create it. That's not their policy. It just happens to be a condition of the building.
But you shift to look at then it's a discriminatory to not engage in the reasonable accommodation process, which is what the claim was against the managers.
Yeah.
And my client was not engaged in a discriminatory practice.
Does reasonable accommodation include widening the doorways? Or is it just...
It may.
It may. So they may have to retrofit. And that sort of undercuts, does it not, the... or is somewhat in conflict with the notion of the idea that the tenant at his own expense is going to have to come along.
Correct. There's two provisions. One is at the tenant's expense. Another one is reasonable accommodations.
Yeah.
Which
was not leave any time for your co-counsel.
Thank you.
You better...
Your Honors, I am Carlton Erickson, appearing on behalf of the architect, Robert Stewart. I'll be brief here. We've discussed these issues quite extensively. But I think this is the kind of case that really illustrates the problem that we have. Most of the other cases that have been discussed really do not involve, in a major extent, the designers of these buildings. We've talked a lot about the fact that there are current managers there, the people bought from Mr. Brockway these apartment complexes. The architect, though, has really no way whatsoever to protect his interests in this, following his design of these buildings.
What if he designs a faulty building?
Pardon?
What if he designs a faulty building?
That happened in this case, Your Honor. And
how do he protect himself by complying with the applicable laws? That's the burden on him, and that's why he's a certified architect.
And that's why we're here today, is because the design was not in compliance with the FHA. However, he's even a step further away from being able to ultimately resolve his liability than the builder is. He designed it. He has no power to come back in at this point or at any point and make changes to kind of cut off that potential liability that could come up, as we've discussed, 10, 15, 20, 100 years down the road.
But as to him, that would have been true even within the statute of limitations, right?
Pardon?
That would have been true of your client even within the statute of limitations, as you would construe it, as the district court construed it, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So there was a point. I mean, he does his drawings. He never owns the property at all. There might not. He has no means of constructing it or changing the construction. He has no control over how it is actually implemented. He doesn't engage in lease, renting, or anything of that sort, right?
That is correct.
You know, as soon as the ink dries on the blueprints, his work is done.
That is correct.
And so I'm not entirely sure why he's at any worse point today than he was 6 months after he finished his work.
Perhaps that's why we have statute of limitations, Your Honor, is at some point the courts and the legislatures have determined that you need to cut off some liability here so that a party can go on with their lives, so that they can make sure that they have...
Right. What I'm pointing out, though, is that the argument he can't do anything about it is not a very good argument for you, because he never could do anything about it. So you are in no worse position today than you were years ago while the statute of limitations was still active.
On that point,
That time has not made that any worse, right?
I'd have to agree with you through that analysis.
So what you really have to argue is that enough is enough. Time has passed. Let bygones be bygones.
For all the other reasons that the developers have argued today, Your Honor, those same reasons apply to the architect in this case.
But less.
But less, yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I understand.
Your Honor, it looks like our time has run, and
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you wish to take it. You should take a minute for rebuttal. Do you want to take a minute?
If I may.
Give you a minute for rebuttal. You don't have to take it all.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, obviously the counsel for the designers and constructors, they want to get their clients off the hook, and I understand that. I think we're all sympathetic to their position because it is a concern that liability can continue. But we have a statute, and the statute is clear that the violation...
If it were all that clear, your side wouldn't have lost so many times.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If it were all that clear, your side wouldn't have lost so many times.
Actually, Your Honor, our side has won the majority of the cases around the country. In fact, the old St. Andrews Court, which was the decision was issued by the Sixth Circuit, just recently observed that the overwhelming majority of district courts have sided with our side and have applied equitable tolling or continuing violation doctrines to recognize that liability continues. In fact, only Nevada and Idaho have followed the Maseki decision, which has drawn a hard line at design and construction. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.